From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the Jack and Spike Show.
Welcome back to the Jack and Spike Show. A couple of towns in Washington and Oregon have been named the best places to live in the United States. A little unusual. Never heard of either of these places.
Why they're so nice. Nobody knows where they are.
Little place called Clee Ellum, Wash. That's a joke. No, it's not Clee Ellum. No.
Okay.
They're not going to be nice after this thing gets published. Seattle Public Libraries is resorting to rolling branch closures. They've taken the model from the early 2000s in California with electricity.
Oh, those were rolling brownouts?
Yeah, just going to keep rolling through the grid. Make sure that you don't lose everything. And gas prices are still rising in Washington. Who would have thunk it? It's not like we had a whistleblower who said that this was going to happen, who was fired allegedly because of his whistleblowing. All of this is unusual, but you know, it's not unusual. Mr. John Curley on a Thursday afternoon. How are you, Mr. Curley?
Present and accounted for, gentlemen and lady.
John, how's that thing going with that thing that you were telling me about with the your property? Can you talk about that, or can you not talk about that?
I take that as a no, Jack.
I'm sorry, John. I'm waiting.
Okay. I'm trying to do this in a nice, neighborly way.
So. I like that.
Hopefully. Yep.
So John's having a little bit of a...
If it ends up going to court, then we can talk about it.
So, Mr. Curley, looks like two places have been named the best places to live in the United States. One of them is Eugene, Oregon, and the other one is Camas, Clark County. Now, I've never been to Camas. I don't ever plan on going. But you live in a place that I'm sure is similar to Camas, right? I mean, Clee Ellum is fairly similar, right?
Middle
of nowhere.
Not at all.
A lot of people around, a lot of meth houses.
Now, Camas, Washington, very liberal.
Okay.
Leans hard left, small little town. They make above average income compared to the United States. I think where they, but Eugene's at 113,000 household or something. No, it's a wealthy little town there in Washington, and it's probably demographically the absolute opposite of Clee Ellum.
It's a little bedroom community of Portland on the Washington side of the river.
The first words out of your mouth are liberal.
How can anybody call that a good place to live?
You're trying to compare him to Clee Ellum. Listen, the reason people live there and work in Portland, right? So they drive right over the bridge, so they don't have the state income tax. They go over to Portland and they pay for gas at a reasonable price.
Whether or not the sales tax, and then they drive
back. You know, the sales tax. They bounce back and forth across that bridge to have a nice little life. It's good.
Nice place. Do you ever regret, John, moving out of the big city, moving out to the middle of nowhere?
Not for 1 second. The only time I regret it is when I have to defend it, which seems to be every Tuesday and Thursday at 2 o'clock on this show.
Well, John, the reason I ask that is basically like this. Like, I hate living in major metropolitan areas. I can't stand it. Mostly it's because of the indifference that people have towards the suffering of others, right? Mm. Like, if I went out to Clee Ellum, I'm just gonna postulate this. And you saw somebody who was sprawled out on the sidewalk, you would either, this is what happens in Seattle, you either step around that person, you step over that person, or you point to the person that you're walking with, maybe we should go back that way, and you avoid it. In Clee Ellum, I'm almost positive that if someone was sprawled out on a sidewalk, most people would say, that person obviously needs help, right, John?
Yeah, because you can look at science on that. That if you have a tremendous amount of people don't have time to stop and care for somebody. But if it's a smaller group of people, pretty good chance you know that guy, or you know somebody knows that guy, or it's you. But if you are in a big, big city and things move so fast, there's a terrible video I watched, I don't know how many years ago, but still in my mind. It was in China and the traffic is everywhere. This little girl, she's 2 years old, gets hit by a truck. And she's obviously mortally wounded, and people are just walking right by her. Why?
Yeah.
Because there's just so many people, and no one has time to stop, and everybody just keeps going, and life is fairly, you know, casually overlooked in a whole bunch of ways. So that's why people move to small towns.
I don't think that human beings are designed to live in major metropolitan areas. Mostly because most of the anthropologic research suggests that we developed in tribal groups of about 75 to 150 people. And we hold about that many social spaces in our brain.
Okay.
And now,
yes, exactly. 120 was the, 120. Was the number they looked at.
So now, but we're so overloaded with that, that our relationships become diffuse. So I have a relationship with the guy at my front desk, but not really. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense.
It's not a bonded relationship. And so I think that it causes a certain amount of neurosis. I know that it does for me, because when I see a homeless person walking down Eastlake who's clearly suffering from mental illness, I think to myself, if I would rather live in a community where if this was the case, there would be officers who talk to that person and say, what services can we get for you? Now, most people would say that this is a fiction, but if you go to Capitola, California, it's a town of about 8,000 people. That's what their police force does. They see you're homeless in Capitola. You don't get to be homeless in Capitola. They say, where can we take you? What services do you need?
Do you think people are numb to it in big cities like Seattle because we just see it so much?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. John?
Yes, agreed. Absolutely.
Our conscience have been just worn to a nub.
Yeah, like I saw...
You can't keep giving.
That's the issue with it, right? Like I saw somebody who I thought was either dead or ODing in front of a Walgreens, and I go inside and I say, hey, I think that someone's having some trouble in front of your store. Now, either I could call from me and they'd be like, okay, we'll get there in 30 minutes or whatever.
Right, right.
Or Walgreens can call. So in my mind was, if the lady from Walgreens calls, there's a certain amount of... I don't know, expedited. This was just my rationale.
No, I think you're spot on. A business has a little more gravitas with the folks in the city, you know, than you do as a citizen.
So I think this lady, she's either dead or she's ODing. I walk into the Walgreens and I say, I think that someone's having a hard time in front of your store. And she goes, oh, she's there all the time. Doesn't acknowledge the fact that I said, I think that she's either dead or ODing. She just goes, she's there all the time. This is a societal sickness that I don't think is tenable. I don't think we can maintain it. Because at a certain point in time, you're going to get what they have in China, where people are walking over a 2-year-old, right? That's just my read of it. I know it's very hippy dippy.
I get it, but
let's
take that woman into account for a moment. How many times a day does somebody come to her and say, "Hey, call 911. There's a person out there."
Sidewalk Sandy at it again.
She's probably heard it so many times. Oh, don't worry about it. That's, you know, it's fine. You know, because she's probably it's not an alarm to her. You know, like any kind of alarm, people hear over and over again, they ignore the alarm. But to her, she's just like, nope, she's fine. That's okay. But thanks for telling me.
She's probably called services for that lady on the sidewalk, and that lady has said, oh, I'm okay. They move her along, and then 2 hours later, she's right back.
Yeah. And it's that's why I think to myself, like, if I move somewhere, it's going to be close to the city, but I just can't. The major metropolitan areas are just so draining on just my soul. John, did you experience that as well? Just the drain of watching misery and suffering on a daily basis? Or was it COVID? Because I think it's
I was
almost
living in Sammamish, I didn't see any of that.
Oh, okay. Well, gee, thanks. Wow, John, thanks for taking
that. That was so honest. That was so open. I appreciated that.
Did they have any public libraries in wherever rich town you were in? Because Seattle Public...
Yes, and I voted against it. But just go back for one moment.
Yeah.
The idea of calling out. So you know who Kitty Genovese was? It's just a famous story of the woman in New York City in 1965 who was crying out for help, brutally beaten.
Apparently
nobody helped. Remember, that was the story. But it ended up being an urban legend about her. But it became the big story, which is we have lost her soul and big cities don't care anymore. But she became sort of this, you know, case study of no one heard her cries and no one came to help her. But, you know, that's part of that story. But back to the library, I believe I was the only city council member in Seattle, in Sammamish, that voted against the building of the library in Sammamish.
Yeah, good for you, John. Books are the devil. That's what I always say. Get rid of those
books. A giant building that holds a bunch of books that our community could easily access online, move to digital. If you really, we're so concerned about climate change. Get rid of the building, don't heat it, don't print the book, put it online, you'll save the planet, and you won't have to spend all the money.
That was, John, I'm so glad you said that, because it's such a good talking point, but you said it better than I was going to say it, because the way that I was going to say it is that nobody reads books anymore, everybody reads digital text. Now, I understand all the literature that suggests that turning a page is good for your brain and that your retention is better when you're actually reading a hard physical copy of something. But everything that I read digital. I don't use. Yes. And so if we took these libraries and they offered online services. And you kept the librarians, because librarians, the reason that you have to go to school for so long as a librarian is not so that you know the Dewey Decimal System. It's so that understand how to gather research for people.
So you can spot a 16-year-old in a fake mustache that can't have that book.
Exactly. Librarians are basically research and categorization experts. So if you need a primary source from Juan de Fuca or whatever, you can go to a librarian and they know how to find it within the system that they have. So you keep the librarians, but you move it to a digital model. And if you need someone with research assistance, you can do a Zoom room call or you can go meet with that person.
Can I ask you, both you guys, I'd love your opinions on this. Is there any value to a little kid detaching themselves from a tablet or a screen to read a book so they understand? You talk about reading on digital. I get it. We're all moving toward that direction. I do it myself all the time. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a little kid who you ask him to read a book on tablet, this is where the games are. This is where Bluey is. This is where all the fun is. Mm-hmm. Is there any value to having a kid step away from electronics and just hold a book? Maybe if we only have libraries for the littlest among us.
John?
It's a wonderful, wonderful world that you have conjured up in your imagination, Spike.
Thanks, Mr. Potter.
I don't know.
It's my bad ear.
I think that the days of the page master are gone, where Macaulay Culkin goes into the library finds the three books that whisk him away to an enchanted realm and Christopher Lloyd is there. Like, those days are far behind us, unfortunately. That's 1994. I think that if you're going to try to get kids into reading, you have to approach them on the unfortunately, using the technology that they're already familiar with.
Also have to teach them how to read.
Yeah, yeah. So, Spike knows this, but John, I don't know if he knows. I have to use this particular program to read certain things because I have a little bit of the touch of the lexia.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a program that bolds every other letter in a text so that I can, so my brain doesn't go, because I will take a word, Justin experienced this the other day. I was reading copy, and instead of saying complete, I said compete. Because in my brain, the word is compete. And I said it many times before we just stuck on complete, and I couldn't read it anymore, right? So there's a way to, I guess, to encourage kids to read or have them be able to read. I don't know why we keep doing the public library thing, even though it's nice and even though it's cool and even though it's a great service. I just don't think that we need so many of them, and then two, that they need to exclusively be these places with hard copies.
Are we privileged to assume that every kid in America has access to electronics or the internet?
I think it's in the 90th percentile.
No, it's not. I don't think it is.
Yeah.
I don't know. Nope. Well, I'd love to see some research. I'd love to be proven wrong because it doesn't happen enough in my day. But
if the parent reads and there's books in the house, the child has, there's
97%
the child will read.
Have access to electronics, digital, a tablet.
But if there's a book, my father was a voracious reader, tons and tons of books. We had a whole big, giant section in the family room was all books. And my mom was reading all, my dad was reading all the time, my sister, my brother. I have dyslexia too, so now you go through. But I didn't read at all, but the books were always present. You watch your parents read, the joy of the reading. My dad would finish a book, goes, there's a keeper. He'd put that one down and pick another one up. It's like, always reading something.
It's actually a Playboy inside of a book.
My mom had the same issue. I remember when Burt Reynolds came into our home. Saucy bastard.
So gas prices are rising in Washington State. We all know that that's a thing. If only there was a whistleblower who had told Jay Inslee that it wasn't going to be pennies, that it was indeed going to be in excess of 50, 60, 70 cents. Who could have seen this coming? John, I have yet to talk to you about the carbon tax and what a disaster that has been. I'm curious what your because this is basically like how to save pennies at the pump, but it's basically like drive less, right, is their ultimate advice.
They say live in Camas and drive across the river to get your gas, what they tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and no jackrabbit starts. They're completely ignoring, the problem.
Yeah.
You want to solve it? You want to bring gas prices down by 50% when you get a chance to vote in November? Blast that climate crap out of this world and vote to overthrow the climate pennies on the dollar or pennies on the gallon crap from Inslee. That's going to be one that people are easily going to vote out. That's one of the initiatives. So get rid of that.
I'll give you that one. But would you also support anti-gouging legislation?
What's a gouge? How do you prove a gouge?
I think you prove a gouge when you show record profits.
So how about
month after quarter after quarter?
Was it 2012 or 2020? They had record losses. Do we do something when they have record losses?
I believe we compensate the oil, or we subsidize the oil industry more than any other industry on the face of the earth. So I think we do when they have record losses. We do.
This would be my retort to that, Spike, because we've had this conversation now four or five times.
You know me, I'm slow to learn. I appreciate it.
The reason that they have record profits is because they have to offset the cost of the carbon tax, thus artificially inflating the price of the actual good that they deliver, thus artificially creating record profits, which would not exist had that carbon tax not been there in the first place. That price always gets passed off to the consumer, as we see here with the rising gas prices. That would be my...
Yeah, I understand. And Inslee was trying to do, hey, don't look here, look over there. Oh, we're going to create a law that's going to go after gouging or, you know, obscene profits. I've never seen anybody actually describe what an obscene profit is. But they're providing a product that is on the international market. It's an international commodity. And if you have more barrels and you're producing at least 90 barrels, then you're making good money. But if you're below, I think it's like 60 or 40 barrels coming out, then you end up losing money. It's really simple, just number back and forth. But they're not really gouging you. It's not the gas station making 1 or 2 cents on each gallon of gas. The state makes a tremendous amount of money off of us driving from point A to point B. But this idea, and what would you do if you went after the profit? Do you think you would have more people investing in that industry to make the industry more efficient, or do you think you'd have less? If they found out the government was taxing more, you would get less of it. It's always the simple equation. You want more of something, then you would like to be able to have more of something, then give it more money. If you want less of something, then tax it. It's simple. If the governments are taking more, a higher point, if you can make more than this, we're going to take 90%, well, then people won't invest. You won't have more drilling, you won't have more product, and the price will go up.
Economics 101 with Mr. John Curley, who you can listen to every Monday.
That's Milton Friedman, by the way. This is Milton Friedman.
Uncle Milton. Learn some economics.
I love him.
There you are. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Curley. We appreciate it.
I got to get ready for my show.
That's right, my friend. I'm going to be speaking to two Curleys today.
Are you really?
I'm going to be speaking to the littlest Curley later this afternoon.
Really?
Yeah. They want to learn about yoga.
Oh, look at you. Nice. Uncle Jack.
How to become a yoga instructor.
Nice. So
I get to be good old Uncle Jack to the youngest of the Curly clan. What's the best way to say that? The Curly crew?
Curly clan's good. Yeah, I like it.
It's got a little bit. Maybe it's not the best. Curly clan. Okay. Right? Oh. Curly crew.
I have to retake the C word.
Curly cohort, mayhap. Is that
the
another
Curly
one?
Bunch.
Laura.
The Curly bunch.
Laura, you have a degree in English. What is a good way for me to say this?
The curly camp.
Ah.
Look at that. Unoffensive. Yep.
Trad wives, stay-at-home girlfriends, and the dream of feminine leisure. The Washington Post has an article about this because the idea of a trad wife, if you've never heard that, it's becoming quite popular amongst the youth, because a trad wife, the old Betty White, you know what I'm talking about?
Sure.
The old
stay-at-home mom.
Right, stay-at-home mom. You don't got
to
work.
The June Cleaver.
You betcha. I'll take care of you, baby. That's what a trad wife is. So why is this becoming the dream of feminine leisure when it's really more like indentured servitude? We'll find out when we get back right after this. That's right, our YouTube channel where we do digital exclusive content. For instance, you can watch Spike and I get into a huge fight, literal fist fight, over O.J. Simpson, where Spike was defending the man's honor, and I chose to defend the honor of Ford Broncos. And Spike and I went to blows over that issue, and you'll have to watch the video that comes out at 3 in order to see who won that physical altercation. Thankfully, we have traditional values. Great segue for me, because trad wives are back in the news. What's a trad wife? Traditional wife. Came very popular right around COVID to start talking about what a traditional wife does. Making sourdough bread, being at home, not working, running the household, right,
yeah,
is a basic
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, yep, yep.
And there was this kind of surge of trad wifery that came out of that era that is now slowly starting to die off because people are realizing that being a trad wife in many ways is very boring.
It's nice to have things like credit cards, too.
Right, yeah, that's nice, yeah. Right? But I actually think in many ways it's actually kind of like, in some ways it's very beautiful, and then other ways it's very demeaning, because being a homemaker is an important thing.
It is.
If you're, yeah. if you're homeschooling your kids, if you're... You got a lot of kids. Like Jay Skorheim's got 12, 13, 14 dozen kids.
14th is on the way.
He's got a lot of kids, so it makes sense. He's got a trad wife. Right? I mean, you got that many kids. It's a lot of mom time is needed to raise kids.
Sure.
But in other instances, it just seems kind of demeaning to have that expectation for a woman who doesn't want it. Does that make sense?
It does. You know, it's funny because a lot of women would really love the opportunity to not have to go to work every day, mm-hmm. not have to drop their kids off at daycare or school every day, mm-hmm. and have the luxury of managing a home, you know, having hobbies.
The luxury. This is coming from Spike Hunia. The luxury of managing a home.
You know, you often say that the downfall of our society mm-hmm. starts in the home.
It does.
Right?
Yep.
And it does, isn't this where we find ourselves, that one income doesn't cut it anymore? Both parents got to work.
I think you might be missing a piece of what a trad wife is supposed to do. Because it's not just I stay at home and I do my wifely duties.
Well, okay. Is there more? I have a personal understanding of what a trad wife is.
A trad wife is I am second to my husband, meaning that my husband makes all of the decisions in my house.
Head of the household.
Head of the household. I follow my husband's word as if it was the word of God.
I don't have that.
Because it is, right? It's God, and then he talks to the husband.
Right. God doesn't talk to women.
For many trad women, it's the responsibilities of the house as a whole are my responsibilities, meaning that my husband does not do laundry. He does not do dishes. He does not walk the dog, right? And these aren't simply nice things that I do for my husband. This is what the expectation is, and this is where the term wifely duties comes from. It comes from Christian fundamentalism.
I've got a budget to run the household. If I go over that, that's on me.
Exactly. Right.
I can't ask him for more.
Exactly. Right.
Okay,
so
yeah,
like some people have a very picturesque version of that where it's, yeah, I stay at home and I'm a stay at home mom. That's a very different thing. Trad wife is basically a live-in servant. Right. For in the way that it's being portrayed in this particular article, and the way that many people, or at least I should say many men, expect it to be, you will perform your wifely duties. Otherwise, you are in violation of our covenant before God, which is a completely different way of thinking about what it means to have a partner in a relationship.
This story is talking about feminine leisure. That's not.
Well,
that's a kept woman, right? That's what they're talking about.
Have you guys read the Dennis Prager essay, Why It Is a Woman's Responsibility to Give Her Husband Adult
Relations?
Time? Adult
yeah, okay,
time.
Okay.
Whether she wants to or not.
No.
You've not read that article?
No, I won't.
Dennis Prager, Conservative Beacon, wrote an article talking about how it is a woman's wifely duty to provide, duties for her husband
with a T, not a D,
whether she wants to or not.
Yeah,
that is disgusting. And for some reason, that man still has a radio show.
That's
right?
The PragerU guy, right? Right.
That's the PragerU guy, yeah. Right? So, point being is that's how dark and deep it goes with men who literally want to have a slave wife, where you don't get to say no to anything. And so when people have this nice like version of trad wifery or whatever, I say, sure, in some cases that makes a lot of sense. In other ways, the Dennis Prager model is maybe the most horrific way I could envision my wife, right?
Sure.
You will do everything that I say, whether you want to do it or not. What? That is a gross power trip. And men who treat their wives like that should be embarrassed.
That's viewing another human as a lesser being.
Right.
For your convenience and pleasure.
Laura, how do you feel about being a trad wife? How do you feel about it? Not that you are, but if you were to be one.
Sure. So my take on this is really simple, which is that you should feel free to be a stay-at-home mom mm-hmm. if you would like, but you do take huge hits when you enter a more traditional role in terms of your earning power.
Mm.
The only situation in which I would consider a trad wife or stay-at-home mom type of setup is if I have an ironclad prenup where I'm being given
yes.
a certain sum of money that is just for me every year that I stay home to take care of the kids.
Mm, I like this. And this is good trad wifery.
Then when I re-enter the workforce, I won't have lost my earning. I will have lost my earning power, right? Taking
yes.
a few years off.
Yeah.
But I won't be stranded, because I think that these relationships get dangerous when you are entirely dependent on one person
yeah.
to pay for everything. And we have seen time and time again, women get a divorce or, like, often not of their choosing,
right,
and are truly left with nothing.
There was a very prominent conservative commentator, I shall not mention his name, Stephen Crowder, who is getting a divorce.
Okay.
And someone from his team leaked. This is the biggest guy on Rumble. This guy's got like 5 million subscribers. Someone from his team leaked the divorce proceedings. His ex-wife was being paid $25,000 a month, and everybody lost their minds. Oh my God, look at the matriarchy. Look at how oppressive this is. Right. Not realizing that his wife helped him start that company, had a share in that company, invested her livelihood into that company, invested personal finances into that company, and yes, was owed a stipend to take care of her newborn twins because she could not physically work. Do you know what I mean?
I hear you, buddy.
So what is so fascinating about this is that when I look at a lot of people who talk about traditional, when they talk about trad wives, they don't even take into consideration the sacrifice that somebody makes in order to fulfill that role, to the point where when a woman leaves a man and then she is awarded what she is owed from the time that she invested into that company, people go, oh, look at that lazy lady. Look at how lazy she is using the courtroom to steal money, right? But not even realizing the amount of effort that she put into making that business successful.
You know, I've never had a fully encompassing understanding of what a trad wife is. This has helped me a lot. A trad wife, from the description you guys are laying out very well, I might add, is somebody you can't, how could you respect somebody who accepts that role?
Christian, right?
I wouldn't want to be with somebody who would be willing to accept that kind of a role.
I don't know. Laura, what's the mentality of a woman who says, I'm going to be a trad wife?
And especially in like a Christian fundamentalist context,
sure.
Women are raised into that role. They don't know that there's other ways that they could live.
More for them out there.
Right? Yeah. And I do think, though, too, that there's a lot of videos right now on TikTok, social media, showing all the shiny, fun parts of being a trad wife. Women going shopping at Louis Vuitton or baking things from scratch and playing with their kids. And it's not a realistic portrayal of A, what can happen to you down the line, and B, how exhausting it is to be a homemaker, how that really is a job.
A woman discovers a 20-million-year-old fossil while walking along the Oregon coast, and all I feel is deep resentment and envy. Find out why when we get back right after this. Why can't I ever find anything nice? Is a question that I asked myself when I read this story. I was just filled with resentment, envy, jealousy. I want this life. Why can't I have this life, Spike? This is the thing. Nice things happen to everybody else, but never me. Why can't I just be walking down the street, find a nice Rolex? Why can't I just be walking down the beach and find a priceless fossil? This happens to everybody except for me. Do you see what I'm saying?
I hear you.
You're telling me some random woman is just walking down the Oregon coast and she finds a 20-million-year-old fossil. Basically priceless, right?
So yeah, well, you ever heard the Sheryl Crow song, it's not having what you want, it's wanting what you have?
I can't hear anything. I'm deafened by rage right now. I can't hear anything other than the fact that I'm upset. Because I can't stop reading about, hey, this guy in Tennessee found a bunch of Civil War era doubloons in his backyard. This guy found a, you know what Joe Bonamassa got the other day? Joe Bonamassa, guitar player.
The guitar virtuoso?
He found a 1954 Fender Telecaster Blackguard that has original Charlie Bigsby pickup right in the neck, factory made, right? Wow. It's one of a kind. It's a real unicorn. Why did he find it? I don't know. He was walking down a beach on the Oregon coast. Found a priceless guitar. There it is. Why
he spent 10,000 hours in guitar stores. That's how he found it.
Why can't nice things ever happen to me is why I just raise my hands up to the skies and I just say, why, God? Why can't nice things happen to me? Why does it always have to be tragedy and death that happens to me? Why can't I just be walking down the street and find a priceless artifact out of nowhere? Why is it everybody else but me? Answer that question, Spike. Otherwise, you're fired.
Because this lady spends untold hours walking up and down the Oregon coast looking for stupid stuff. Even a stop clock's right twice a day. Eventually, she's going to come across a 200-million-year-old piece of dinosaur dung, which I think is what that is.
No, it's teeth.
Is it teeth? It looks like dinosaur poop to me. I don't know the difference.
It's a tooth from a Desmocetylian, which resembled a hippopotamus and spent most of its time in the ocean. Isn't that fun? Isn't that fun? Not for me, because I didn't find it.
So did she find it because of, you know, I guess erosion revealed it? It's been buried for centuries and millennia.
Yeah, this is really a story about our Washington coastlines.
This is really a story about how I'm being cheated out of having nice things. Andrew, you have a good I found something cool story in your life?
No, not really.
Okay, great. Sorry. Live radio. Nate Connors, you got a really good one. You got a good I found something that was really nice story.
Are we on live radio?
Yes, yeah. We are.
Oh, shoot, no.
Okay, everyone's fired. Laura, do you have a nice I found something cool story?
I wish I did. I've never even found money on the ground.
Spike?
I found a briefcase with $10,000 cash in it.
Ew.
I swear to
what?
You, I did.
Yeah.
I found a briefcase with $10,000 cash.
What was the story?
A gentleman who ran a small business in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. and we had just moved into this temporary, long story short, this guy came knocking on my door a day and a half later. Hey, did you happen to see anybody pick up a briefcase?
Mm-hmm.
He'd put it on the roof of his car and driven away, and it had gotten almost a block and a half away
wow.
from our house, where I saw it on the side of the road, and being a young 20-something, I said, that might be worth something. I picked it up and brought it in, and I gave it back.
Yeah.
Gave it back.
Tears in your eyes, you say that story.
I thought for about five seconds.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I haven't seen a thing. Good luck out there.
So when I was working as an usher at a movie theater, it was my first foray into show business, was working in a movie theater. I was in charge of cleaning the aisles after the movie.
Yeah.
And as I'm walking down the aisle, sometimes you find wallets, you find keys. So all of a sudden, I see this thing looks like half of a marble. I go, what is this thing? And I see a green eye staring right up at me from the, it was a glass eye. That's something.
Was it stuck to the floor? Is that way it didn't roll all the
way
down to the bottom?
No, it was in the case. And the person, I'm assuming they had taken it out during the movie and then put it in the case. And then the case fell out and it opened on the floor, right?
Oh, that's so...
And so I pick it up and I go, well, I win the award for weirdest thing found in a movie theater. And then about 30 minutes later, a guy comes in and he's wearing sunglasses and he goes... Did anybody find a case that looks like a braces case? And I go, glass eye! And he goes, yeah. Is there any? And I go, yeah, I got it right here. I got your glass eye right here. I start shaking it in the thing. No, I'm kidding. But I was so impulsive as a 19-year-old, I did say, glass eye! Because I was so excited that I found a glass eye.
You know, did he offer you a reward?
No, he just thanked me and was horrifically embarrassed. You know, the weird thing about when you're working in that setting is as a movie usher is you get an insight into people's lives that they don't normally, you know, showcase to everybody. For instance, the fact that they have a glass eye.
Hey, very true.
That's our show, everybody. Andrew A+, my friend Nate Connors. Dang,
yeah,
Nate
check
Connors.
It out.
What is that new?
Yeah, it looks like it, doesn't it?
Jeez.
I wash cold and I hang dry.
Oh, Nate, that's got to be right out of the men's warehouse spring collection.
It is.
Button-up plaid on a Thursday. You mad lad, Nate Connor.
Thank you.
Laura, A+. Spike will give you a solid C+ today.
Thanks, buddy.
Good job. Here's your quote of the day.
Nice shooting, son. What's your name?
Let him drink mud. It's more fiscally responsible if they drink mud.
We're trying to be more fiscally conservative,
right.
And we'll win this election.